It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
An early childhood taxing district, what on earth is that?
The latest in politics and world affairs.
I don't think that we should be passing legislation that is so complicated that people kind of throw up their hands and say, I can't understand that.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
And it's not fair just because you're a big business that you get a break on this and the little guy doesn't.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You're each treasured, you're valued, you have purpose. Today, strive for excellence, take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. My friends, we were made for this moment in history. And thank you to the team. That's producer Joe, Luke, Rachel, Zach, Echo, Charlie, and all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting. I'm blessed to work with amazing people. Check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter that goes out on Sundays, and you will get first look at our upcoming guests as well as our most recent essays. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com, and thank you to all of you who support us. We are an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. And we are pre-recording these shows for Independence Day week. And with special guests, so thrilled to have on the line with me the creator of the American Minute, and that is Bill Federer. Welcome, Bill.
Kim, great to be with you.
Well, I can't believe how many books that you have written. And we've talked about the Declaration, and at the end of the show, I normally will share a quote. I thought, well, I'll see if there's a Bill Federer quote that I could share. And then I do this quick search. Oh, my gosh, there's not just a quote. There's a book you have, and I've got to order it, America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. So tell me about this book.
Right. Well, it's 845 pages of God and country quotes arranged alphabetically by the person. So Abigail Adams is at the front, and Jefferson and Lincoln and Madison and George Washington and Booker T. Washington. And it is the one book that I have that people say that I use. The other ones they say, oh, I've read, but this one I use. And I've had congressmen. I was out in Texas not long ago, and Louie Gohmert came up, and he said, I can't tell you how many times I've quoted out of your book on the floor of Congress. And
oh, my
gosh.
The
Supreme Court had a case in 2003. It was called the City of Greece, New York, where they had a city council open with prayer in Jesus' name. ACLU sues to stop them. And Anthony Kennedy wrote the decision. He said, even our Continental Congress opened with prayer in Jesus' name. It's okay. And gave the prayer and then gave the source, W. Federer, America's God Country. And it's been a resource for teachers and students and papers. And that's our most popular book. It sold over 500,000 copies. Focus on the Family sold several hundred thousand copies of it. And but I've written about 30 books since then. One's a series my wife and I did called Miracles in American History, stories from our country's past where there's a crisis, it looks hopeless, and they pray and have courage, and things turn around. Rivers rise, allowing Washington's troops to escape. You know, fogs come in. Sergeant Alvin York, capturing 132 Germans, World War One, comes back and starts a Bible school. Patton had his... Third Army coming to the rescue of the 101st Airborne, and at Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge, and he's pinned down by the weather, and he gets his chaplain, James O'Neill, and orders him to compose a prayer, and they print it on 250,000 index cards, give it to the soldiers as Patton's Christmas greeting to his troops on the flip side. Well, they pray it, and the next day the sky clears, and they're able to march and stop the Nazis in their blitzkrieg, and a couple months later, the war ends. And so it's just a fascinating collection of these stories called Miracles in American History. Did one on the history of socialism, another on the history of Islam, another on the history of St. Patrick, another on the history of St. Nicholas, Christmas traditions. And one, I went through all the speeches of FDR.
Interesting.
I was amazed that he was in office 12 years, got elected four times as president. They since passed the 22nd Amendment limiting a president to two terms. But I read through all of his addresses. he was Episcopalian. He gave out Gideon's New Testaments and Book of Psalms to all the soldiers in World War II. He wrote the foreword. As Commander-in-Chief, I take pleasure in commending the reading of the Bible to all who serve in the armed forces. And this was the liberal FDR passing out New Testaments. And so since then, both the left and the right have moved to the left. And it's just a fascinating history that in that particular book.
Boy, absolutely fascinating. But I need to get this because I share quotes all the time on the show. And what a great resource. It sounds to me like it's one of those books. Again, people should have hard copy in their Freedom Library at home because it can give inspiration. We are, Bill Federer, in quite a time right now, and we're broadcasting this the day after Independence Day. And I feel that we are in the third founding of our country right now. We are really being asked, who are we as Americans? And that's why looking at our history and taking hope and inspiration from these stories of our founding and the Civil War and the Battle of Gettysburg was fought July 1 through July 3. This is such an interesting time. And then the fact that 50 years after the Declaration of Independence in 1826, that both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson die on the same day, and then James Monroe, who was one of our presidents as well, he died on Independence Day. This doesn't seem like it's by accident to me.
Right. We forget the fact that we're unique. So one of the books I did called Change to Chains, it's a play on words there, but I go all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. So not prehistory, not handprints on cave walls. We're talking an actual functioning language. And you have Sumerian cuneiform is invented around 3300 BC. You have Egyptian hieroglyphics invented around 3000 BC. Chinese pictogram characters invented around 2600 BC. But you round it out around 3 or 4,000 BC is when what we know as writing was invented and record keeping was invented. And we're around 2080. So that's around 5 or 6,000 years of human beings writing down human records. But during this period of time, the most common form of government is what? Well, it's gangs. The default setting for human government is gangs, clans, tribes, and a gang leader with enough weapons we call a king. Uh-huh. And they go by different names, Pharaoh, Caesar, Kaiser, Sultan, Tsar, but power wants to concentrate into the hands of one person. And it's a selfishness. It goes back to Cain killing Abel. The only difference is the weapon improves. Instead of Cain killing Abel with a rock, the kings can kill with bronze weapons or iron weapons or big, long phalanx spears that the Greek soldiers had or a scimitar sword that the Muslims had or gunpowder that the Chinese invented or ships with low keels that the Vikings invented or, cannons. The weapon improves, but it's that same fallen nature of Cain killing Abel. And as the centuries go on, the King of England ended up being the most powerful king on the planet. The sun never set on the British Empire. They had India, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, British Guiana, Canada, Barbados, Bermuda, Jamaica, and America. And our founders decided they didn't like a globalist, one-world government king telling us what to do. And so they broke away and flipped it and made the people the king. So kings have subjects who are subjected to their will. The republics have citizens. The word citizen is Greek. It means co-ruler, co-sovereign, co-king. So when the citizens pledge allegiance to the flag and to the republic for which it stands, we're basically pledging allegiance to us being in charge of ourselves. And so, but when somebody protests the flag, what they're saying is, I don't want to be king anymore. I protest this system where I participate in ruling myself. It's like, okay, somebody else will be happy to tell you what to do. And so America is an experiment of bottom up versus top down. And when they set up the Constitution, they basically took the power of a king and broke it into three branches, executive, legislative, judicial, pitting them against each other. So James Madison said, there's no angels on earth to govern us. All we have is humans, and we're all selfish. And so the selfishness in the executive branch will always try to pull power away from the legislative and judicial. and the selfishness in the legislative branch will always try to pull power away from the executive and judicial, and the selfishness in the judicial branch will try to pull power away from the executive and legislative. So greed checks greed, ambition checks ambition. And it's actually a stroke of genius. It would be the equivalent of a Sunday school teacher giving an assignment. Go home and design a system of government where sinners keep other sinners from sinning. That's what our constant greedy, selfish people keep keeping other greedy, selfish people from being greedy and selfish. And so, and then they took the power and separated federal to state level. And then they tied up this federal Frankenstein with 10 handcuffs we call the First 10 Amendments. In other words, their whole preoccupation was to take the power of a king and scatter it. Take the Tower of Babel and scatter it. They had experienced what it was like being under the most powerful, concentrated king in the world and in world history, the King of England. They said, we've been down that road. Let's go down the other road. Let's trust the people. Let's decentralize it. That people may make mistakes, but we've been down the other road. We know where it leads. Let's try this. And so America is an experiment of people ruling themselves. And it only works if the people have morals and virtue. And all the founders wrote about this. Plato wrote about this in his Republic. He says that a democracy only works if the people have virtue, and if they give up their virtue, it turns into lawlessness. And then when there's lawlessness, people want somebody with enough power to restore order. And then along will come a protector who's all smiles, who promises everything to everybody, and he'll start concentrating power. And if people cast it in his teeth that he's getting too powerful, then he has a choice. Give up the power, which he's not inclined to do, because Plato called them a lover of power, or get rid of the people confronting him. And he purges his military, his police, his Department of Justice, of anybody with morals and virtue, and all in which is yes men. And then he finally stands up in the chariot of state, holding the reins of power, and he's revealed as the tyrant. So democracies and republics where people don't have virtue, don't have morals, where you teach your kids there's no right, there's no wrong, you can do whatever you want, every day it changes, and you shove these kids out on the street and it's lawlessness, then you're going to have people saying, government, you got to do something to stop all this random violence and killing. And the government says, we're happy to. We're just going to take away your Second Amendment. We're going to take away your freedom of speech because you might set somebody off. We're going to take away your privacy so we can track you everywhere. And so whenever I did another book on the history of socialism, whenever you have a dictator wanting to take over, the first thing he does is to create domestic crises. Mm. Right, let in illegals and let there be lawlessness and you have the currency become devalued. They want to create a lawless situation so that the public begins to cry out for somebody to come in with enough power to restore order. And then they come along as the hero saying, we'll restore order, but when the dust settles, you've just given up the bottom-up form of government and transition to a top-down form of government. And So you learn these lessons from history, but at the time of America's founding, we were breaking away from the most powerful king on that planet Earth had ever seen. The sun never set on the British Empire. And so it's fascinating. In my I did another book called Who is the King in America? And it's the people. I go through, where did America's founders get these ideas? Well, they got them from the Age of Enlightenment, but prior to that, they got them from the New England pastors. And where did they get their ideas? From their little congregational churches, which was different than the hierarchical church. And these churches, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Quakers, they got their idea from the Reformation. What part, they referred to the Bible, but what part of the Bible, that first 400 years out of Egypt before King Saul?
Okay, so let's have that as a stopping point for right now. I'm talking with Bill Federer. He is the creator of the American Minute. How many books have you written?
About 30.
He's written about 30 books, and we were talking about his book, America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. Highly recommend that you get that into your Freedom Library at home. And we have these discussions because of our wonderful sponsors. One of those is the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Team, and they know that life can be challenging, so it's their mission to maximize your financial security as you manage the risks of everyday life. So call Roger Mangan at 303-795-8855 for more information. Like a good neighbor, Roger Mangan's team is there.
So I switched my insurance to the Roger Mannion State Farm Insurance Agency. Get this. I actually talked to Roger Mannion, who has been helping people with their insurance coverage in our community for 47 years. He helped me create a State Farm personalized price insurance plan for my home and auto and explained affordable options. For personalized service and peace of mind that you are working with a team that cares about you and your family, call Roger Mannion now at 303-795-8855. Kim highly recommends the Roger Mannion State Farm Insurance Team. Again, that number is 303-795-8855.
There are always opportunities in changing markets, and the metro real estate market is no exception. That is why you need to work with seasoned RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine when you buy your home, sell your home, consider the opportunities of a new build, or explore investment properties. Rising interest rates are spurring creativity, innovation, and opportunity in the real estate and mortgage markets. Kim Munson highly recommends award-winning RE/MAX Realtor Karen Levine. Call Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516 for answers to all your real estate questions. That's 303-877-7516.
It's Friday!
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We're an independent voice, and we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. Something's a good idea. You should not have to force people to do it. And a couple of great sponsors of the show, goal sponsors of the show, is the Harris family. I so greatly appreciate them. And also the National Shooting Sports Foundation. And the National Shooting Sports Foundation represents the nation's manufacturers, retailers, and distributors of firearms, optics, ammunition, and other related sporting goods and media. And they have a government relations team that's watching what's happening regarding our Second Amendment, our right to keep and bear firearms so that we can protect ourselves and our families. And they stay on it. And so it's wonderful to have them as sponsors of the show as well. On the line with me is Bill Federer. He's written over 30 books. You can find him at The American Minute. And we're talking about several of his books. This America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. Would highly recommend that all of us have this in our homes, in our Freedom Library. As we went to break, you had just mentioned the Israelites in the 400 years in the Bible. So what was that reference about, Bill Federer?
Right. So you have the kings of England look to the Bible for their authority, but they look to the King Saul and on part of the Bible, and the Calvinist Puritans and Baptists and Presbyterians and Quakers and Congregationalists that founded colonies in America, they look to the pre-King Saul part of the Bible. This 400-year period of millions of people and no king. So we go back in history. King is the norm. Around 1400 BC, you have an anomaly. You have millions of Israelites coming out of Egypt, and they come into the Promised Land. And for 400 years, there's no king. It's totally unique in history. It's so counter. And it's not like the Greeks and Romans, right, where they do a trial and error. You know, you read through the Greek history and Lycurgus, and they'll have, like, different, you know, committees of the plebe, the wealthy, and the patricians, and they're out of them. Israel was a one download. It all came down at once, and it's a system where everybody is taught the law, and everybody is personally accountable to God to follow the law. The law wants everybody to be fair to each other, and God's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal. Nobody's around. You know you can get away with it. And then you think, God's watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable in the future. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country really believes this, you can maintain complete order with no police. Maximum liberty. And women can go anywhere without fear. You don't have to lock the doors. Right? And it worked for four centuries until the priest stopped teaching it. You say, what? Yeah, here's Eli, the high priest. His own sons are sleeping with women in the very tent where the Ark of the Covenant is. And then another Levite with a silver graven image in the house of a guy named Micah. The tribe of Dan comes along, steals the graven image, and tells this Levite, come along with us. You can be a priest to our whole tribe. And you're reading the story in the book of Judges, scratching your head, saying, what's this Levite doing with a graven image? Isn't that one of the commandments? You're not supposed to have them? And then the terrible story of a Levite with a concubine. The law says the Levite is to marry a virgin of his own tribe. Here he is with a woman he's not even married to. They're traveling. Their house gets surrounded by sodomites. Something about that behavior that appears at the last stages of a people ruling themselves, this casting off the self-restraint. The poor concubine's raped to death, and by the time you're grossed out, you read this line, every man did that which was right in their own eyes. Why? Because the priest stopped teaching them what was right in the Lord's eyes. They lost the fear of God. They lost the knowledge of the law. It turns into this selfish lawlessness, and they all go to Samuel the prophet. And they say, this self-government system's not working anymore. We want to be like the other countries. We want a king. Samuel cries, and the Lord tells him, they did not reject you, they rejected me. And so they get King Saul. Now, why is this story important? Because the kings of Europe look to the Bible for their authority, but they look to the King Saul and on part of the Bible. The divine right of kings, God chose me. And the Calvinist Puritans that founded New England, they looked to the pre-King Saul period of the Bible. Millions of people, everybody taught the law, accountable to God to follow it. So King Saul is the divider between England and America.
Wow.
And so why is this important? Romans 13. People that are, go to church might be familiar with this verse. It says, let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. It's like, okay, in a monarchy, the authority is the king. And in a republic, the people are. So Romans 13 is understood differently in a monarchy versus a republic. In a monarchy, subjects submit to the king. In a republic, the citizens are the king.
Interesting.
The politicians are your servants. You hire them, you fire them. You vote them in, you vote them out. They're supposed to do what you tell them to do. So the churches that say, oh, we got to submit to the government, got to submit to the... They need to pick up and move to China and North Korea. And when Nebuchadnezzar blows the trumpet, they just surrender their country. Okay, I'll bow, right? But in America, we're the pre-King Saul part of the believers of the Bible. We're where we don't have a king. Everybody's taught the law and personally accountable to God to follow it. And the politicians do what we tell them to do. And so when you get into this unique, and John Calvin was the one that pioneered this. So you had the Reformation in 1517, Martin Luther, and then you have large percentages of countries not believing the way their king does. So wherever there's a king, you have to believe the way the king does, or he burns you at the stake, or it's considered treason. But in 1572, Spain controls the Netherlands, and the King Philip II does not like the fact that the Netherlands have now become Dutch Reformed. And so he sends the Iron Duke of Alba to Antwerp, Holland, and he commits the Spanish Fury. He kills 10,000 of these Dutch Reformed and leaves their bodies lying in the streets. And the same year, 1572, the Queen of France, Catherine de' Medici, does not like the fact that 10% of France has become Huguenot Protestant. And she's a little more creative. She organizes a wedding of the main Huguenot leader, Henry of Navarre, with her daughter, Margaret. And it's in Paris. And all the Huguenot leaders are there a couple days after the wedding. She has her soldiers pull chains across the streets so the carriages cannot ride out of town. And she sends her men house to house. They kill 30,000 of these Huguenots and throw their bodies in the Seine River. And so you had lots of killing going on at this time. You had Catholics killing Protestants, Protestants killing Catholics. Don't want to get into all that. But in the French-speaking area of Switzerland, you have a guy named John Calvin. And he says, we are subject to the men who rule over us, but subject only in the Lord. If they command anything against him, let us not pay the least regard to it. So there's a caveat there where there's a situation where you don't. And it's like Ephesians 6, children, obey your parents. But what if there's a bad parent who tells the kid to sell themselves into prostitution? Is that child supposed to obey that parent? No. The child obeys the parent as long as the parent's telling them to do something that lines up with God's word. You obey the government as long as the government's telling you to do something that lines up with God's word. Why would God tell you to do something in his word and then tell you to submit to a government that tells you not to do what he just got done telling you to do.
Fascinating.
It's exactly what Martin Luther King Jr. wrote in his letter from the Birmingham jail, 1963. One may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. One has a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law or the law of God.
Wow.
So these Calvinist Puritans come up with a way to have a government without a king. It's called a covenant form of government. And you get rights from the Creator, and you are fair to your neighbor because you're accountable to the Creator, and he's not a respecter of persons. You get blessings from the Creator, and you voluntarily share them with your neighbor as charity, right? Because you're doing it as unto the Lord. It's not socialism where the government takes away your stuff involuntarily and distributes it to supporters in exchange for votes. No, this is where it's your stuff, and when you're moved upon, you... And so this covenant form of government is a way to maintain order without a king who rules through fear. So kings rule through fear all the way from Nimrod on. That's the electricity. That's the motivating force. The king ultimately can kill you. And so that's the norm. You have a bad king, you fight, you get rid of him, you put in a good king. But then his son is bad, and now you're back where you started, and you have to overthrow him, and then you put another good king, and his son is bad. I mean, who's the best king? David. David's oldest son, Amnon, rapes his sister, Tamar, and then is murdered by another brother, Absalom, who tries to overthrow David. I mean, this is David's own sons, right? And so the brilliance of a covenant form of government is you get rid of a bad king and you maintain order with the covenant form of government so that the rubber band doesn't snap back with the new king. And so this is, it only works if the people fear God rather than fear the government. And so Calvinist Puritans come up with this covenant form of government. It's taken to New England, and that's what they set up in these colonies. And so these Puritans would have one building in each town called a meeting house. That's where the pastor would teach the Bible, and that's where they would do their city business. The word synagogue means meeting house. That's where the rabbi would teach the law, and that's where they would do their city business. Why build a separate building just to talk about a different topic?
That's a good
and
point.
So the Puritans had a key word, participation. So everybody's involved in church, just like the pre-King Saul part of Israel. Everybody was involved, the assembly of the Israelites. Just like Jesus said, upon this rock, I'll build my church. That word church in Greek is ekklesia. Ek, ek means out of, and klesia means a calling. So there were 6,000 citizens in the Greek city of Athens, and they would call them out of their homes to the Agora marketplace, and they would all get involved in fixing the city. Right, we got to fix the walls, got to get our navy going, got to take care of the kids, and everybody is a part. And Jesus chose this word. He said, upon this rock, I'll build my ecclesia, my calling out, my body. The body of Christ, everybody has to be a part, an eye, an ear, a foot, right? So it's a participation model versus the hierarchical model that the King of England had. It was, the king had a clergy-laity model, where the clergy does the ministry and the laity is lazy and watches them, right? You got the king, under him is the Archbishop of Canterbury, Archbishop of York, and the deaneries and vicars and curates and rectors and priests, and your relationship with God is through this hierarchical structure, and you're watching them do the ministry. But the congregational model is where the pastor trains the saints to do the work of the ministry. You get involved, and as you're faithful in the very little, you're entrusted with more, and everything that grows takes in and gives out. Every muscle to grow has to be exercised. You don't just hear a good sermon and watch somebody else minister. You hear a good sermon and then put yourself in a position where there's a need, and the Holy Spirit will use you to meet the need. And it's training the body. And so this congregational model is what the Pilgrims and Puritans and Baptists and Presbyterians and Quakers and Congregationalists brought to New England. So that was the 1600s. It was a amazing century of developing this covenant form of government. But after a century, it got a little dry.
Okay. Well, let's keep that as our cliffhanger there, Bill Federer. And I wanted to mention the USMC Memorial Foundation. And I know where I'm going to be on August 24th because they're having a great event to commemorate the 47th anniversary of the Marine Memorial, which is located right here in Golden, Colorado. It's hard to believe, but it's right here. And it's time for a facelift, but it's going to be a great event. And you, the performer will be Dave Bray, USA. And you can get your tickets by going to usmcmemorialfoundation.org. That's usmcmemorialfoundation.org. And for that steakhouse experience at home, make sure that you go to Lavaca Meat Company.
Lavaca Meat Company takes great pride in selling only the best. Lavaca Meat Company is a third-generation family-owned business with its roots in eastern Colorado. Lavaca means the cow in Spanish. As our name implies, we only sell beef. No poultry, pork, bison, or game. Just premium quality, aged, mouth-watering beef. Our store is located at the corner of Main and Nevada in the historic Coors Building in downtown Littleton. For a steakhouse experience at home, visit us in person or shop online at lavacameat.com. Lavaca Meat Company, only the best. Again, that's lavacameat.com.
Boson Law fights for clients who've been injured or family members who have lost a loved one due to the careless, reckless, or wrongful conduct of others. Whether injured in a car accident, suffered an injury due to a product or bad pharmaceutical drug, or need help fighting for medical care and benefits following an accident at work, don't go it alone and uninformed. Boson Law is the law firm you need in your corner. Time is of the essence with any personal injury claim. Call 303-999-9999 to schedule your complimentary consultation. That number again is 303-999-9999. Call now.
You'd like to get in touch with one of the sponsors of The Kim Munson Show, but you can't remember their phone contact or website information. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, MONSON.com.
It's finally Friday. I'm free again. I got my motor running for
Welcome back to The Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And thank you to all of you who support us. We're an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do it. A great organization to support, particularly this week of Independence Day week, would be to make a contribution to help the Center for American Values continue the great educational programs that they are putting together, as well as honoring our Medal of Honor recipients. And so check out all that they're doing by going to AmericanValueCenter.org. That's AmericanValueCenter.org, and make a contribution. It's a great way to say thank you for my freedom. On the line with me is Bill Federer. He's the creator of the American Minute, which you hear every day in between my hour number one and hour number two shows right here on KLZ 560. And we're talking about his two of his books. He's written over 30. One is America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations. And we're going to be getting to silence equals consent. But our cliffhanger, Bill Federer, was you said in the 1600s there had been this covenant form of government, but it was getting a little dry. So what happened?
Right. So it's in the Puritan mindset is God has a plan. He has a plan for government. He has a plan for your life, your marriage, your family, everything. Some took it the next step and said, God in his infinite wisdom already knows who's going to wind up in heaven, so don't even bother preaching the gospel. And they became unevangelistic. And David Brainerd got expelled from Yale because he said his professor was as spiritual as a chair. And the Yale students got reprimanded because they went into the town of New Haven and they were caught presenting the gospel to strangers on the street. It's like, oh, how terrible. I mean, they weren't like tearing things down and setting things on fire. No, no, no. It was considered disrespectful that they weren't licensed yet to preach. And they did not have black robes on. They were not in a formal setting of a church. And it was considered disrespectful. And so when the 1700s came along, you had what's called the New Lights. And these are people that say, look, it's more than a plan. You have to have an experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life will change. And you won't do worldly things anymore, like go to bars and brothels and get involved in government. Wait, what was that last thing? Yeah, government. It's worldly. If you're really a Christian, you're not going to be involved in government. You're going to be holy. And it's like, well, wait a second. That's different than the first century of America. This first century, you had participation. You had people involved in church, and you had people involved in civil government, where now they're coming along saying, no, don't be involved in government. It's worldly. So let's unpack where the Pietists came from. Reformation starts 1517 because Martin Luther had a personal experience with Jesus, right? The just shall live by faith. So personal, he was willing to stand up to the most powerful government leader in the world, the King of Spain, at the Diet of Worms trial and say to his face, unless you can prove me wrong from Scripture, here I stand, so help me God. It was very personal to Martin Luther. But some German princes have been waiting for a chance to break from Rome. And they say, this is my chance. Kingdom of mine, I just decided you're all now Lutherans. And the people in the kingdom are like, great, we're Lutheran. What do we believe? And so for the people in these kingdoms, it's not the same personal experience necessarily that Martin Luther had. It's just a new state doctrine. So a revival movement starts called Pietism that said being a Christian is more than doctrine, even if it's good doctrine. You have to have an experience with Jesus. And when you do, your life will change and you won't do worldly things anymore like bars and brothels and lewd theater and get involved in government. And it turned into the German concept of the two kingdoms, the kingdom of the government, the kingdom of the church, the two don't touch. And so where the Puritans said, you can do two things. You can be a spouse and you can be a parent. Two completely different roles, but one person can do both. You can do two things. You can be involved in church stuff. You can be involved in state stuff, but not the Pietists. Their key word is withdrawal. They're like, no, don't be involved in state stuff. It's worldly, and you're now holy, so you got to withdraw. So that brings up a scenario. If all the spiritual people withdraw from politics, who's left to be involved but the less spiritual? And because they're less spiritual, they're going to yield to their power-hungry side and ambitions. And so there were even German princes who donated money to the Pietists so they would teach their people not to get involved in the prince's business. Here's a little more money. Stay out of my hair. I mean, it's like George Soros and Rockefeller's giving money to woke seminaries to teach Christians not to get involved in politics, while at the same time, they're giving money to LGBTQ activists to get them involved.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Well, four centuries of this teaching, this two-kingdom teaching in Germany, allowed Hitler to put Jews on train cars. And they're going right past the churches crying for help. And the people in the church can hear them crying. But their response was, well, that's the government doing that. And we're the church. And we can't get involved in government stuff because we're holy. So let's just sing praise songs to Jesus louder. It's like, can anybody see there's something wrong with this picture?
There's something wrong with this picture. Bill, I want to interject here. Producer Steve had sent something over from a quote by Martha Gellhorn. She was an American novelist, writer, and journalist. It says, people often say with pride, I'm not interested in politics. They might as well say, I'm not interested in my standard of living, my health, my job, my rights, my freedoms, my future, or any future. If we mean to keep any control over our world and lives, we must be interested in politics. And so I've kept that around just to read that every once in a while.
Yeah, well, the word polis, P-O-L-I-S, is Greek for city. Indianapolis, Minneapolis, Annapolis, Maryland, right? Polis means city, and politics is the business of the city. And in New England, you had churches founding cities. And so there were, like, no non-church members to be lazy and let them run stuff. So everybody was involved in the church, and everybody was involved in the civil government. And but then the revolution starts, and the British send over a military governor, Thomas Gage, and he outlaws meeting houses. Democracy is too prevalent in America. We don't need the people meeting and giving their consent to stuff. You just obey government mandates. And we're like, no, nothing happens in America unless we participate, unless we give our consent to it. And he's like, no, you obey government mandates. And we're like, no, nothing happens over in America unless we participate, unless we give our consent to it. He's like, no, you're a robot. You're a zombie. When the government blows the trumpet, you bow to the statue. You just jump. And we're like, no, nothing happens in America unless we give our consent. Turns into a revolutionary war, and we win. And we set up a government where it's we, the people, government from the consent of the governed. And so our founders did not like governments who ruled through mandates. Matter of fact, the whole purpose of the Constitution was to take the power of a king, separate it into three branches, separate federalist and to state level, tied up with 10 handcuffs. The purpose of the Constitution is to prevent a president from ruling through mandates. Should I say that again? They wanted to stop there from being another king. They didn't like top-down government. And so this was the miracle of America, is where now democracies, like in Athens, every citizen had to be at every meeting every day to talk about every issue. And if you didn't keep up with the issues that they're talking about today, you're called an idiotus, an idiot, right? But it could not grow any larger than a city, so they call them city-states, because you physically had to be there. A republic is where you take care of your family and your farm, and you have someone in your place that goes to the market every day and talks politics. They are your representative. Right. And so it's an easy way to remember. The word republic begins with three letters, R-E-P, and the word representative begins with three letters, R-E-P. So a republican form of government is a representative form. You're still in charge. You just sort of subcontracted out somebody to go in and sit there in your place all day and keep up with this stuff and then report back to you, versus a democracy where you literally had to be there. Now, democracies can be swept up easier with a mob spirit. Plato witnessed an admiral who was in a battle. They won, but there was a storm and a bunch of sailors drowned and he wasn't able to rescue them. And the people of Athens got so stirred up in this mob frenzy that they killed the admiral. And Plato's like, this mobocracy, you know, where a republic, since it's one step removed from the citizens, because they have to take the time, cool down, tell the representatives, and the representatives go and discuss stuff, and then come back and report. There's a little bit of a cooling. Their republic governments change slower. And so, and now in America, we have a constitutional republic. So our representatives have limits, have guidelines, have borders. They can only do a certain amount of stuff. And so we have a constitutional republic. But the idea is that we get to rule ourselves, and when we have a crisis, though, that's when people surrender their freedoms. I put together a book called Socialism, and I go through, if democracies and republics are attempts to take the power of the king, give it to the people, what if the king wants the power back? Does he just ask for it? Hi, I want to be king. Give me control of your life. Most people are in a hurry to give that up. So there's two ways that the king can take the power back: fear and free stuff. You can get the whole entire population into fear. They will panic and surrender their freedom in exchange for security. Or you get them to get dependent on free stuff, and they'll incrementally give up their freedom to keep the free stuff coming. So it's a front door, back door approach. It's sort of like a drug dealer takes over a neighborhood two ways. He can come in with guns, get everybody in fear, and they'll panic and submit to the mob, pay extortion protection money. Or the drug dealer is so nice, he's giving away free drugs until you get hooked. And then you want some more free drugs, you're going to incrementally give up your freedom until you're selling yourself into prostitution. So it's like a hunter catches animals with guns or bait. Guns is a front door approach, and bait is this back door approach. And so those are methods in which the king can take the power back away from the people, the citizens, by creating atmosphere of fear or getting the people dependent on free stuff.
Well, let's go to break. And when we come back, let's talk about your book, Silence Equals Consent, because I think that that is probably one of the most important issues that we have. Over the years, I had felt when they said, don't talk about politics or don't talk about religion, it was a way of actually self-censoring. And I've realized how dangerous that is. So I want to talk with Bill Fetter about that when we come back. We have great sponsors, and one of those is Lauren Levy.
If you're 62 or older, a reverse mortgage could be a great tool regarding retirement and estate planning. It is essential to understand the process. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group has nearly 20 years in the mortgage industry and has the experience to answer your questions. Lauren understands that each financial transaction is personal. If you'd like to explore your options on a reverse mortgage, remodel your home, buy a rental property, or move, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881. Licensed in 49 states, Kim Monson highly recommends Lauren Levy for all your mortgage needs. Call Lauren at 303-880-8881.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
Franktown Firearms has a wide selection of firearms along with fully stocked ammunition and accessories ready for you. Franktown prides themselves on being a family-friendly indoor gun range and shop, always striving to make their customers comfortable. Franktown will work with you and meet you where your experience level is. Their staff and instructors will help you find what you need and develop your skills to a whole new level. Have some fun practicing on the range any day or come in for tactical fun night or ladies' night. For a limited time, they'll let KLZ listeners rent a firearm for free when you rent a lane, Class 3 guns not included. And when you sign up for membership, they'll give you your first month free, just for being a KLZ listener. So come find out why everyone loves Franktown Firearms today. Learn more about this one-of-a-kind gun shop and range at klzradio.com/Franktown. Franktown Firearms, where friends are made.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of our sponsors. And a sponsor that's been a great sponsor of the show for many years, as well as America's Veteran Stories, is Hooters Restaurants. They have five locations: Loveland, Aurora, Lone Tree, Westminster, and Colorado Springs. Great lunch specials and a great Wednesday specials on Wednesdays. How I got to know them, it is really an important story about freedom and free markets and capitalism and PBIs, politicians, bureaucrats, and interested parties that want to control things. And this was something that happened when I was on city council. That whole story is at my website, kimmunson.com. This is the final segment with Bill Fetter. He is the creator of the American Minute. We've been talking about two of his books. One is America's God and Country Encyclopedia of Quotations, and then his book, and that is Silence Equals Consent. And there's so many people these days, Bill Fetter, that they don't want to get involved. They're afraid that if they get involved, they might rock the boat. Their jobs might be on the line, or relationships might be on the line. And I used to adhere to this, to not talk politics or religion, because they said you don't do that in polite company. It's like, well, wait a minute, what do you talk about? But what I realized, what it really was a form of self-censorship. So I think all those things are connected, Bill.
Right. So to those that think they're being holy by not being involved, what do you do with Numbers chapter 30? It's the silence equals consent chapter. Half a dozen scenarios. One, if a daughter is still living in her father's house in her youth and binds herself with a vow, and the day the father hears about it, if he's silent, her vows stand. But if he disallows it, she's released from the vow. That's come down to us as vows in a wedding ceremony. And the pastor tells the church members, if you are silent when you hear these vows, you're giving your consent. Speak now or forever hold your peace. It's called the rule of tacit admission, T-A-C-I-T, and it's in real estate law. You save up money, buy a rent house. If somebody moves in, a squatter or something, and they're not paying rent and you're not trying to evict them, they can gain title to your property through adverse possession just by you being silent. It's in debt collection law. Somebody owes you money, you wait 10 years to try to start collecting. The judge will say you're past the statute of limitations. If you really thought they owed you money, you would not have been silent for so long. It's in trademark law. You design a trademark, somebody flat out copies it, and if you know about it and you do not defend your trademark, they get to use it. It's in our U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 7. Congress passes a bill, puts it on the president's desk. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, the same is law in like manner as if he had signed it. His silence equals a signature. And so if church members are silent at a wedding ceremony, and that's their consent, if they're silent when they're killing babies in the community, they're giving their consent. And so Leviticus 20, any Israelite who sacrifices a child to Molech to be put to death, but if the members of the community close their eyes when that man sacrifices one of his children to Molech, I myself, the Lord, will set my face against him and his family. I'll cut them off from Israel. All you got to do is close your eyes while they kill the kid, and you're guilty. Acts 22, the Apostle Paul's talking to the Lord, and when the blood of thy martyr Stephen was shed, I stood there silent, consenting to his death. Paul didn't throw a stone or say a word, but he knew he was guilty. Proverbs 24, rescue those who are unjustly sentenced to death. Don't stand back and let them die. Don't try to disclaim responsibility by saying you didn't know about it. Esther 4, Mordecai tells Esther, there's a mandate from the government to kill the Jews. If you're silent, you and your father's family will be killed, and God will raise up somebody else to deliver Israel. Numbers 20, Moses and Aaron are at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord says, take the rod, gather the assembly, thou and Aaron, speak to the rock, water will come forth. Well, they gather the assembly. Moses hits the rock once, hits the rock twice, water comes out. End of the chapter. The Lord spake to Moses, Aaron will not enter the land because both of you rebelled. And he's like, both? We just read the chapter. Aaron didn't do anything. He didn't say anything. Yeah, that's just it. He was at the door of the tabernacle. He heard God say, speak to the rock. When Moses lifted up the rod the first time and hit the rock, it probably took Aaron by surprise. When Moses lifted up the rod the second time, Aaron knew what was coming, and he did not protest. He was silent. So Moses's was a sin of commission. Aaron's was a sin of omission. Leviticus 5, a person sins because he did not speak up, even though he was an eyewitness to a case or knew what happened. Even Martin Luther King Jr. said, he who accepts evil without protesting it is cooperating with it. We all know the verse, Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself. The verse right before it says, confront your neighbor directly so you will not be held guilty for their sin. Another translation says, rebuke your neighbor directly and you'll not incur guilt because of them. So they're loving each other, and they're rebuking each other. Right? Proverbs 9, rebuke a wise man and he'll love you. Love thee. Ecclesiastes 7, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than the song of fools. John 17, Luke 17, if your brother sin, rebuke him. And so you can do it nicely. 1 Timothy 5:1 says, rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father. What does entreat mean? It doesn't mean being silent. You're speaking up politely. And so they have a woke tactic, and it's to guilt trip Christians into being more Christian than Christ. Say what? They say, yeah, if you're really Christian, you'll be silent and give your tacit approval to us teaching something that Jesus would never teach. I mean, would Jesus teach the trans agenda? We know what Jesus taught. Matthew 19, he who made them at the beginning made them male and female. I mean, think of it. Here are school counselors who cannot even define what a woman is. Yet they think they can tell that a little boy is supposed to be a little girl. It's like, you can't even define girl. It's totally illogical. Jesus warns, if you allow one of these little ones who believes in me to sin, better that a millstone be put on your neck and be thrown in the depths of the sea. So all these people that think they're being spiritual by not being involved, we don't get involved in politics. It's going to be a rude awakening when they realize by their silence, they are giving consent to all the evil that's going on out there. They're inviting the judgment of God on their heads. You know, the answer is local. So there's more people that go to church in an area than vote in a school board race. And the answer is, say, look, we don't agree with every church on every doctrine, but none of us are happy with what's being taught. Let's just vote some mama bear in and then pack out the school board meeting early so they don't beat up on her. And if churches can just care about the children that live around their church, all the higher races will take care of themselves. And, you know, as more power concentrates into fewer hands globally, God's counterbalance is to get more people involved locally. Right.
Oh, good
we
point.
All see the George Soros and Klaus Schwab powers concentrating. Yeah, God's counterbalance is to get more. I'm convinced God wants to have an end time revival, and it's not going to be through one or two big name preachers. It's going to be through the body of Christ participating, everybody getting involved. You know, some people say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to wait for Jesus to come back. So I have a question for you. Who do you think you're going to meet when you're raptured? Jesus. Does Jesus love the little children? Yeah. You think he might wonder why you didn't do anything to protect him? Wow. We're not in North Korea where you don't vote. We're in America where the citizen is the king. And then there's sex trafficking of children. Jim Caviezel's movie, Sound of Freedom. And just 2 months ago, Scott Bottoms introduced a bill in Colorado for minimum punishment for those caught buying 1 to 5 year old children for sex. And every Democrat voted against it. And the churches are silent. They're selling children. The churches are silent. It's like they're in Germany and they're carting the Jews off to be killed. Churches are silent. You know, the Salvation Army started because William and Catherine Booth wanted to stop child sex trafficking in London. They would go to a poor family and say, give us your daughter. We'll give her an education. As soon as they get her out of the door, they put her in a brothel. And Catherine Booth said, I felt as though I must go and walk the streets and besiege the dens where these hellish iniquities are going on to keep quiet. Seemed like being a traitor to humanity. That's how the Salvation Army got started.
Wow.
And so I think that it's a time that we, you know, we're the bride of Christ, and every romance novel builds up to a decision-making moment. And I think God is pushing the world to a decision-making moment. Some people are going to go with the all others. They're going to want to be liked and friended and followed. And there's others of us that says, you know what? I tolerated something I didn't feel good about. And then I stretched the rubber band some more. But I'm sorry, I can't be silent when they want to do a hysterectomy on a little 8-year-old girl because she went through a tomboy phase, or they want to castrate a little boy because he played with his sister's dolls. And you cut the rubber band and it snaps back. And I think God is pushing the world to this decision-making moment where we show on the outside what we really, really believe on the inside.
Wow, that is absolutely such great, great nuggets of wisdom during this interview. How can people find you, Bill Fetter?
Well, thank you, Kim. My website's AmericanMinute.com.
That is AmericanMinute.com. Bill Fetter, thank you so much. These are such special interviews, and Godspeed on all the great work that you're doing, and thank you.
Thank you, Kim.
And our quote for the end of the show, I went to James Madison, and this is one of the things that Bill was alluding to as our founders were putting together our Declaration and Constitution, that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. So today, my friends, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, if honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you. God bless America. Stay tuned for hour number two. And I don't want no one to cry, but tell them if I don't survive. I was born free. I was born free. I was born free. The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.
It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
An early childhood taxing district? What on earth is that?
The latest in politics and world affairs.
I don't think that we should be passing legislation that is so complicated that people kind of throw up their hands and say, I can't understand that.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
And it's not fair just because you're a big business that you get a break on this and the little guy doesn't.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, and welcome to the Kim Munson Show. Thank you so much for joining us. You are each treasured, you're valued, you have purpose today. Strive for excellence. Take care of your heart, your soul, your mind, and your body. My friends, we were made for this moment in history. And thank you to the amazing team that I work with as producer Joe, Luke, Rachel, Zach, Echo, Charlie, and all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting. Before we get into all of this, I wanted to recognize Laramie Energy and Karis Oil and Gas for their gold sponsorship of the show. We are realizing that reliable, efficient, affordable, and abundant energy sources powers our lives and fuels our hopes and dreams. And so that's why we continue to shed light Oil and gas industry and the coal industry as well, because they've been helping us thrive and prosper for many, many years. We are pre-recording all of these shows for the week of Independence Day. I'm calling it Independence Day Week. And so pleased to have on the line with me, you know him, Colonel Bill Rutledge, retired United States Air Force. He is 95 years young, and he's traveled the world. He has this intellectual curiosity about people and places. He's an avid reader. Colonel Rutledge, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, Kim.
And you had mentioned a while back Hap Arnold, who really is storied regarding the United States Air Force. And I think it's appropriate to talk about him this week of Independence Day week. So for people that don't know who Hap Arnold is, why is he important?
Well, one of the reasons he's most important is he's really considered the father of the United States Air Force as it is today. Now, Billy Mitchell, who was senior to him when he was a young officer, was sort of like the prophet. He said, eventually, we will have a separate Air Force, and he pursued that his whole career, and it led to his court-martial eventually and early retirement. But Hap Arnold was the guy in the trenches who worked from the staff level and worked all the way from learning how to fly an airplane directly from the Wright brothers and all the way through the command of the largest Air Force in the world at the end of World War II. So he's a very significant man for the 4th of July because he helped protect our nation and our Constitution.
Well, and in World War II, there was not a separate Air Force. It was known as the Army Air Corps at that time.
That's correct. And he worked directly, of course, for the Chief of Staff of the Army, which was General Marshall. And he and General Marshall had met when they were both second lieutenants in the Philippines in the early 1900s.
Well, let's start at the beginning regarding Hap Arnold and how he got his name. I think that that's pretty fascinating.
Well, it is. Hap Arnold was born June the 25th, 1886, on a farm in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. And his father was a country doctor. My grandfather was a country doctor in that same era, so I can identify a lot of this. But he was a very healthy, happy young boy, and even from when he was an infant, his mother didn't use his regular name, which was Harley, Henry Harley Arnold, but she chose to call him Sonny. I used to have a roommate named Sonny in college. And then other people found that he was just a very happy person. He was a happy child. And he was that way his life. He exuded friendship. And so they started contracting. Instead of calling him Happy, they called him Hap. Well, it hung on. So did for the rest of his life. Everyone referred to him as Hap Arnold. So it was a description of his personality, and it fit him perfectly.
I had always thought maybe it was some kind of a nickname for Henry. So it's so fascinating to learn that. And I find inspiration in that attitude as well. So his father's a country doctor, and he had aspirations for his boys, yes?
Yes. He had two sons, and he wanted his elder son, who was just a couple of years older, to make a military career and to go to West Point. But his older son chose instead to be an engineer, and he went to Pennsylvania State. And so when Hap came along and he was raised in the agricultural area, his interest was not necessarily in military per se, but he loved riding horses. And the possibility of going to West Point was all right because they still had a large cavalry element, and you could be, actually be a cavalry officer. So he went along, and his father got him an appointment. The first time it wasn't available, but the next year it was. So he went. He entered in the class, a class of 2007. I mean, 1907, which began in the summer of 1903 when he entered the academy, and he was a pretty regular guy. He was well received, and he still aspired to be a cavalry officer. And however, the order of merit at the academies, especially in the academic field, determines who gets the first choices of assignments. Most of the very top academicians within a graduating class went to the Corps of Engineers because it was more scientifically oriented, and they felt that they were being rewarded. Hap didn't aspire to become an engineer, but he did aspire still to be a cavalry officer. But he didn't end up that high in his class. So he was appointed as a second lieutenant in the infantry. Now, his father tried to use some of his political contacts to get Hap, get him a different unit and a different career field, but that didn't work. So Hap went on active duty as a lieutenant, and very shortly after he did, he had an assignment to the Philippines. And this was in that era after the war with Spain, and where we had acquired control like a colony of the Philippines. And he went out there for a two-year assignment, and that's where he encountered Lieutenant Marshall. And it was interesting.
Let's keep that as our cliffhanger.
Sure.
Colonel Rutledge. We're talking about Hap Arnold, who is known as the father of the United States Air Force, and we thought it very appropriate to talk about him this week of Independence Day week, which we are pre-recording. And we are sponsored by amazing people.
And very pleased to have on the line with me Jim May. You know him. He is with Lavaca Meat Company. He's also a cowboy poet. And Jim May, welcome. Happy Independence Day week to you.
Yeah, good morning, Kim. Happy Independence Weekend to you. I know we're recording this. I'm looking really forward to the 4th here this year. We're heading into the Rockies game, I think. I shouldn't give a lot of this away, but it's the 3rd here, so we're recording. But we are going to the Field of Dreams in Greeley, Colorado. Our family, actually Dan's sister-in-law, they own the Bigfoot sod farms up there, and they are. Every year they have a big 4th of July party, and you go out on the field and set off the fireworks. When we get started early, and then we'll do the 4th, and you'll be hearing this on the 5th. But I'm excited about the Independence Day weekend coming up.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. And you have written a poem for Independence Day. So what do you have for us?
Yeah, as Baxter Black would say, I'd like to indulge in a little naked patriotism here for you. I wrote this just the other day. I think it's only a day or two old. I just call it simply America. She's that statue in the harbor with her torch held high. She's the mountains in Colorado that reach up to the sky. She's four faces etched in stone on a South Dakota hill. She's that T-bone on the fire that's cooking on the grill. She's the yellow rose of Texas at the Fort Worth Rodeo. She's the flag on the Capitol when the wind begins to blow. She's the racetrack in Daytona beneath the Florida sun. She's Churchill Downs in May when the horses start to run. She's the bridge in California they call the Golden Gate. She's an arch there in St. Louis from the Show Me State. She's the midnight sun in Alaska as it's setting on the ocean. She's the geyser in Wyoming when Old Faithful goes in motion. She's a wheat field out in Kansas of golden waving grain. She's the wind in Oklahoma followed by the rain. She's the harbor in Boston where the ships all come and go. She's the Mississippi River, and she's the Gulf of Mexico. She's the canyon in Arizona. Her Colorado River is so grand. She's the beaches in Hawaii, ice blue water, pure white sand. The beacon of freedom for nearly 250 years. As her birthday rolls around again, it's time to stand and cheer. She's defended by her soldiers in all corners of the world. That's why we salute her flag each time that it's unfurled. She represents over 300 million people yearning to stay free. She's the spirit of America. She's the land of liberty. Happy birthday, Uncle Sam. Thank you.
Oh, Jim, that's really well done. Thank you. And that's just hot off the press. And that's Jim May. And Jim, I highly recommend this 4th of July weekend that people stop by Lavaca Meat Company and pick up some hamburger or some great steaks for the grill.
I want to tell you this. I hope you'll come by. Just look at this as the whole holiday weekend, and I hope you'll come by and pick up a steak for your grill or some hamburgers or whatever turns you on. This is a good weekend to really go out and get to grilling. There's a couple places in town, the Grand Central down a couple of blocks down the street are serving our steaks and our hamburger. As we speak, I'm sitting here in Flagler, Colorado, and as luck would have it, there's a great big American flag in front of me, and the word Flagler is spelled in stone as you go by an interstate. Most people that travel Interstate 70 much would know this little landmark, and I pulled over here because it was a high spot to talk. But
I know exactly where you are right now, Jim May. And again, I'd highly recommend that people stop by Lavaca Meat Company at the corner of Maine and Nevada in Littleton and pick up something for your Independence Day weekend. And the show comes to you because of great sponsors like Lavaca Meat Company and also the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Team. So call Roger Mangan at 303-795-8855 for a complimentary appointment. Like a good neighbor, Roger Mangan's team is there.
So I switched my insurance to the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Agency. Get this, I actually talked to Roger Mangan, who has been helping people with their insurance coverage in our community for 47 years. He helped me create a State Farm personalized price insurance plan for my home and auto and explained affordable options. For personalized service and peace of mind that you are working with a team that cares about you and your family, call Roger Mangan now at 303-795-8855. Kim highly recommends the Roger Mangan State Farm Insurance Team. Again, that number is 303-795-8855.
There are always opportunities in changing markets, and the metro real estate market is no exception. That is why you need to work with seasoned RE/MAX Alliance Realtor Karen Levine when you buy your home, sell your home, consider the opportunities of a new build, or explore investment properties. Rising interest rates are spurring creativity, innovation, and opportunity in the real estate and mortgage markets. Kim Munson highly recommends award-winning RE/MAX Realtor Karen Levine. Call Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516 for answers to all your real estate questions. That's 303-877-7516.
It's Friday!
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is kimmunson.com. And sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You'll get first look at our upcoming guests as well as our most recent essays. This week of Independence Day or Independence Day week, we are pre-recording our shows. And so pleased to have on the line with me Colonel Bill Rutledge. And we're talking about Hap Arnold. Colonel Rutledge was in the Air Force, and Hap Arnold is known as the father of the Air Force. And we left it where Hap Arnold is in the Philippines, and you said that he is that's where he met Marshall, correct?
Yes, they were both lieutenants, and one of the interesting things was Arnold had mentioned to someone else there at the time that I just met a young officer that I think will be chief of staff of the Army in the future.
Wow.
So he was a true prophet in his own time.
Wow.
And then also he noted while he traveled around in the Philippines that there were a lot of Japanese there and a lot of Japanese photographers at all sorts of strategic areas for defense of the islands, and that the Philippine people actually were in fear of an early Japanese invasion. Now we're talking now a few years before World War I.
Wow.
Because Japan was already in the direction of greater control of the Western Pacific, and they had already defeated the Russians and had already had made incursions onto the mainland. So they were planning ahead, and of course when they were there in the Philippines taking pictures and everything, they didn't really think about that. The American military didn't, but it was to come to pass. And the only reason the Japanese were there is for preparation for later. And they did, in fact, involve themselves in World War I. But the only reason they did it was so that they could acquire the Mariana Islands and some of the Marshalls and also other properties that belonged to Germany. So again, it was all an expansion program that they had projected for many decades ahead. Long-range planning by the Japanese military.
Well, you think about World War II and the bombing of Pearl Harbor, but you don't really think about all the strategy and the planning and how many years that took to get to that particular point in time.
30 years.
Wow.
30 years in the planning.
Okay, well, what happens then with Hap Arnold?
Well, he finished his two-year tour, and he received an assignment that was going to be on Governor's Island with the infantry. And the Governor's Island is a large island. Just as you're entering the port of New York, it's to the right as you come into the port. And it has been a government center for military and intelligence for decades. So he was to go there. But he decided that instead of coming back to the West Coast, that he would go around the world. So he went down to Hong Kong, then he went to Singapore, and he got aboard an English ship that was going to London and going through the Suez Canal. So he met a number of people there. Now, when they got to the coast of France, he decided to get off and go into Paris. And this was going to be part of his educational return trip. When he got into Paris, he found that while he'd been aboard ship, and they had been talking, you know, with other English people, he had heard that there was a big prize of £100 being offered by the London Daily Mail for anyone who could fly across the English Channel. So a number of people were trying. In 1909, Louis Blériot, a French pilot, made a 36-minute flight from Calais on the French border, French coast, to Dover, the shortest route you can get to get over the British English Channel. And I've actually been to both places, and I've taken that route, but not by airplane. And so he got the prize, and in turn, with all the excitement, his airplane was brought back to Paris and was hung up over one of the main boulevards there. And so when Arnold went to Paris, he saw this thing hanging up in the air. He had no idea what it was. So he asked, and as he said in his West Point French, what is it? And they told him a little bit about the story. But he expressed no interest in flying. This was just his first acquaintance with an airplane. So he had continued on, went to on to England, and then came back to America. And so he got back over here, and he still was not enthralled with being an infantry officer, but he learned that there was a possibility that he could get a transfer where he wasn't working directly in his field, because the Air Force, not the Air Force, the Army at that time had some people who were in the Signal Corps and perceived that if they could get an elevated picture of a battlefield, that was very important for planning purposes, especially for artillery. So they said, well, we were going to buy one or more planes from the Wright brothers. Well, they put out a notice that they were looking for two young officers who would volunteer to go to Dayton, Ohio area and learn how to fly from the Wright brothers. So he volunteered, and therefore he went out and was one of the first members of the United States Army to become a pilot.
That's a remarkable that the Wright brothers are the ones that trained him.
Yes. And in those days, they didn't have mechanics or machine, a crew chief or anything. If you're the pilot, you also had to know how to maintain the airplane. If it needed repairs, you did the repairs. It was all on your back. So he learned from the bottom up. And he never, in his whole career, he never was a fighter pilot. He never was a bomber pilot. He never was a squadron commander of tactical air, either during combat or for training. But he got his foot in the door, and he got an interest in aviation as opposed to being an infantry officer. But he was still in the infantry. So gradually what happened after he learned how to fly, he and one of his co-pilots decided they were going to fly out over the Long Island Sound area up near Connecticut. And they actually crash-landed their airplane out in the sea and were rescued by the Coast Guard. And after that, he didn't do much flying. He went back and was more a staff officer working for Billy Mitchell. Now, Billy Mitchell was, at that time, a major, had recently returned from a very successful duty up in Alaska, where he worked on ground communications, laying cables and doing all sorts of things. But the Army recognized his ability. They had moved him back to the War Department's headquarters. So he was a major.
Okay.
And Hap Arnold was a lieutenant. He
okay.
told him, he said, you come work for me and you will be a captain.
Okay. Let's go to break here in just a moment, Colonel Rutledge. We're talking about Hap Arnold, and we're going to continue the discussion. We have them because of our sponsors, and one of those great sponsors is Karen Levine.
There are always opportunities in changing markets, and the metro real estate market is no exception. That is why you need to work with seasoned RE/MAX Alliance realtor Karen Levine when you buy your home, sell your home, consider the opportunities of a new build, or explore investment properties. Rising interest rates are spurring creativity, innovation, and opportunity in the real estate and mortgage markets. Kim Munson highly recommends award-winning RE/MAX realtor Karen Levine. Call Karen Levine today at 303-877-7516 for answers to all your real estate questions. That's 303-877-7516.
If you're 62 or older, a reverse mortgage could be a great tool regarding retirement and estate planning. It is essential to understand the process. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group has nearly 20 years in the mortgage industry and has the experience to answer your questions. Lauren understands that each financial transaction is personal. If you'd like to explore your options on a reverse mortgage, remodel your home, buy a rental property, or move, call Lauren Levy at 303-880-8881. Licensed in 49 states, Kim Monson highly recommends Lauren Levy for all your mortgage needs. Call Lauren at 303-880-8881.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
It's finally Friday. I'm free again. I got my motor.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter. You can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We're an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you shouldn't have to force people to do it. And during this week of Independence Day week, be sure and check out the Center for American Values. They're non-political, they're non-partisan, but they're doing beautiful work honoring our Medal of Honor recipients and their stories, and also great educational programs to instill, reaffirm these values of honor, integrity, and patriotism. That website is AmericanValuesCenter.org. That's AmericanValuesCenter.org. We've pre-recorded these shows for this week. Very appropriate during this week to talk about Hap Arnold, who is known as the father of the United States Air Force. And the perfect person to talk to about that is Colonel Bill Rutledge, retired United States Air Force as well. So we're at a point now with Hap Arnold. He's met Billy Mitchell. Billy Mitchell says that he can make him a captain. What happens?
Well, he did. He made him a captain, and he brought him into the War Department. Now, the War Department was the title up until about World War II, when it became the Department of the Army and Department of the Navy and so forth. So he came into the headquarters there, and to do this, he had to return and get a little bit of upgrade so that he was more experienced in flying. So he went back and flew a little bit. This was local. And then he became the staff officer working with Mitchell to analyze aviation being used in war in Europe. There were two Balkan wars, one in 1912 and one in 1913. And this was considered to be probably the first introduction of aviation into warfare. And their principal use in those days, again, was observation, where they could go up and look over at the enemy lines, but then they would have to return and come back on the ground to provide the information. Later, they would make notes and drop them down, but all of this was a transitional period, getting ready for what happened in 1914 when the war really started. But by 1914, when they were starting the war in Europe, Hap Arnold had married, and he and his wife were sent back on a second tour of duty in the Philippines. So they went out there. They enjoyed it. They enjoyed their experience. And then when the war started he came back, and so he's back in America by 1916. We're not yet engaged in the war in Europe. So his boss still was Mitchell. And Mitchell said, well, I would like for you and your wife to go to the Panama Canal area, because we need to establish where we can build some airfields down there for protection of the canal. He, in fact, had orders, was ready to go. And things changed. And what changed was that the president, who had gotten into office, President Wilson, he won his re-election in 1916 by claiming he kept us out of war. Well, he was to be inaugurated for the second time the first week in March 1917. However, about that time, the Germans decided to reinitiate their unrestricted submarine warfare. This was because a lot of the supplies that the British and the French were using were being purchased in America, so that they were helping that side, the Allied sides, against the Germans. And then the Germans also sent what became an infamous telegram, which was called the Zimmermann telegram, that was sent by the German ambassador in America to Mexico, inviting them to start a war with the Americans. And this was intended to keep the Americans out of war in Europe. But the Germans promised that if they were successful, and the Mexicans were successful, then that they would assist the Mexicans in reclaiming much of the territory in the western part of the U.S. that they had lost in the Mexican War to us. We're talking about places like New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, and all the way up to Colorado. So that was a promise. Well, when the word got out of this happening, then our president changed his mind completely and petitioned Congress to get us entered into World War One. And so consequently, Hap Arnold never went to the Canal Zone. That was preempted by what happened internationally. So he went back to the War Department, and he was principally a planner, a logistical person who was helping prepare our people who were going over to Europe. One of the big things was the training programs. So he was very active, involved in basic pilot training in America. But most of our combat flyers learned how to fly in France. And for example, the driver for our commanding general over there went over as a driver and ended up being a fighter pilot. So there are so many things which were in flux, but all this time, Hap Arnold was working in the War Department in Washington, and he did not actually get to Europe until October 1918, right at the tail end of the war. And then his job turned out to be mostly analysis of strategic bombing that Billy Mitchell had initiated when he was a combat commander and had risen to the rank of brigadier general during the war. So there was this ongoing relationship between the two of them, both of whom believed early on that the Air Force should be a separate branch in order to do strategic bombing behind enemy lines.
And so the two men are working together then on this and strategic bombing analysis. What happens after that then?
Well, right after the war, the Germans, of course, had to give up all their weapons. And the German Navy was put out there, and we took some of their ships, and the British took some of their ships, and the French maybe a few. So our U.S. Navy decided that they would go out into Chesapeake Bay and take some of these German ships, and they would practice their long-range artillery shots. Now, they, with their big guns, they could shoot 20 miles, and their plan was to sink one of the German battleships, the Ostfriesland. But Billy Mitchell, who by this time, again, was the senior officer in the Army Air Corps, he asked them if they would permit him to bomb this battleship beforehand. Well, the Navy's concept of bombing the battleship was that he might do some collateral damage, but he wasn't going to do much of anything. So they were magnanimous and said, sure, you go right ahead, because we're going to sink them. So what Mitchell understood was that if he dropped his bombs instead of just on top of the battleship, he could drop his bombs real close to the hull of the ship, and with the right concussion, he could cave in some of that and sink the ships. Well, he didn't share this thought with the Navy, but he went out and he did it. So he sank the Ostfriesland, and the Navy never got one shot off. That started this ill feeling between the Navy and Billy Mitchell for the rest of his career. And it was unanimous. Both he and they had no respect for one another. And it ultimately led for his early forced retirement when he went out later and made a surveillance of Japan and what they could do with air power, made a confidential report in the mid-20s that predicted that Japan would attack the Hawaiian Islands. And not only that, he said he predicted that they would do it by air and that they would do it on a Sunday morning.
Wow. Which is exactly what happened.
That's exactly what happened 15 years later.
Okay. Let's continue on. What happens next with Hap Arnold?
Well, Hap Arnold continued in a staff position with the Department of the Army, and he kept rising because he was a good planner. He was a good organizer. He was especially capable with working with industry and with others to expand our air capability. He encouraged especially for us to work on new bombers that had greater capability. And he was very successful in the 20s and in the 30s. And in the mid-30s, they came out with the B-17, which was ultimately going to be the biggest bomber that was used in World War II in the European theater. So that was finished up in about 1937. And also, they came out with new fighter planes. Before that time, they had been fighter planes that looked almost like training planes. They had a top wing and a bottom wing. So now they were monoplanes, and the P-40 was coming along by Curtiss, and everything was looking pretty good. But in 1938, Charles Lindbergh, who had become a great hero in 1927 and had been also living in Europe and visiting the Germans, he was highly respected there for his engineering knowledge of aviation and his courage in flying. So he had been invited by the Nazi regime to visit their manufacturing facilities all over Germany over a three-week period, and then to test try fly some of their aircraft. And after his experience there, he wrote a personal letter back to Hap Arnold telling him the danger that they constituted, that is the German Luftwaffe constituted, for world peace. And he told him that they had the greatest military aviation in the world right now, and that you have to do a lot to change it. I have a copy of a letter that summarized his position. It's dated November the 2nd, 1938. It says, "Dear General Arnold, I have just returned from a three-week visit in Germany, most of which was spent in trips through various aircraft factories and aviation establishments. This is the third consecutive year during which I have had the opportunity to watch the German aviation development. And I am surely impressed on each visit that the rate of their progress and the magnitude of their progress is huge. Germany is undoubtedly the most powerful nation in the world of aviation, and her margin of leadership is increasing with every month. Now, what he didn't say in here was at that same time, Germany was actively involved in the civil war in Spain, and they had gone down there with their new Messerschmitts and others, and their pilots were learning combat tactics. So they were gaining war experience while all of this was going on and was being ignored by the Americans. So Charles Lindbergh, in his letter, asked General Arnold to please try to make an appointment to come over and visit and see what was going on. Unfortunately, it never happened. One of the reasons it never happened was the letter got there after Germany had already had the Anschluss, wherein they annexed Austria in 1937. And it would not have been politically correct. He would not have gotten the approval of either General Marshall or President Roosevelt. So it was a dead issue. But it was significant to point out that probably the greatest aviator of that era, Charles Lindbergh, had really tried to warn us about the danger presented by the German Air Force.
Wow. Okay. We're going to continue the discussion here with Colonel Bill Rutledge. Before we do that, though, I did want to mention the USMC Memorial Foundation. They're raising money for the Marine Memorial remodel. And what an appropriate time during this Independence Day week to make a contribution to honor those that have given their lives or been willing to give their lives for our freedom. You can do that by going to usmcmemorialfoundation.org. And show comes to you because of our sponsors like John Boson.
Boson Law is a local law firm dedicated to helping injured individuals in Denver and the surrounding areas fight for the justice they deserve. Boson Law focuses on personalized representation tailored to your unique situation, with one-on-one attention and counsel and consistent communication. Boson Law personal injury attorneys have extensive trial experience and have successfully represented clients against the interests of powerful corporations, manufacturers, insurance companies, and government agencies. Contact Boson Law at 303-999-9999 for a complimentary in-person consultation. Again, that number is 303-999-9999. Call now at 303-999-9999.
Focused and wise marketing is essential for your success, especially during tough economic times. If you love The Kim Munson Show, strive for excellence and understand the importance of engaging in the battle of ideas that is raging in America. Then talk with Kim about partnership, sponsorship opportunities. Email Kim at kimmunson.com. Kim focuses on creating relationships with individuals and businesses that are tops in their fields, so they are the trusted experts listeners turn to when looking for products or services. Kim personally endorses each of her sponsors. Again, reach out to Kim at kimmunson.com.
Franktown Firearms has a wide selection of firearms along with fully stocked ammunition and accessories ready for you. Franktown prides themselves on being a family-friendly indoor gun range and shop, always striving to make their customers comfortable. Franktown will work with you and meet you where your experience level is. Their staff and instructors will help you find what you need and develop your skills to a whole new level. Have some fun practicing on the range any day, or come in for tactical fun night or ladies' night. For a limited time, they'll let KLZ listeners rent a firearm for free when you rent a lane, Class 3 guns not included. And when you sign up for membership, they'll give you your first month free, just for being a KLZ listener. So come find out why everyone loves Franktown Firearms today.
Learn more about this one-of-a-kind gun shop and range at klzradio.com/Franktown. Franktown Firearms, where friends are made.
Welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter, and you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. Thank you to all of you who support us. We're an independent voice, and we search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through the lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. If something's a good idea, you should not have to force people to do it. Talking with Colonel Bill Rutledge, he's retired United States Air Force, so it's very appropriate that we're talking about Hap Arnold, General Hap Arnold, who is known as the father of the Air Force. And we've gotten up to where Lindbergh had wanted Hap Arnold to come over to Germany to see what was happening with the German Air Force, if you will. And then Germany annexed Austria. Politically, didn't make sense. So what happens next?
Well, after that, then America recognized that the war was pending, so we actually initiated a national draft in 1940, first time we'd had one in a long, long time, and many people were called on active duty for 1940, 1941. Meanwhile, of course, Arnold is still a staff officer and planning to try to prepare for World War II, should we become involved. All of our attention was basically in the European theater. Lindbergh came back to America, resigned his commission from the Army Air Corps. He was a colonel in the Army Reserve. He resigned it so he could be more active politically. He was a big speaker in the America First program, because we had millions of Americans who remembered World War One and the fact that we'd lost approximately 500,000 people in a European war. And they were not enthused about us getting engaged, period, even though England and France were being pounded. However, when the Japanese attacked in 1941, everything changed. Before that month was over, Lindbergh appealed directly to General Arnold to be reinstated, but it was vetoed by President Roosevelt, because President Roosevelt had a very long memory and he didn't like the political activities of being opposed to build up in us supporting European war. So immediately then we start looking at what we can do in Europe. England was in terrible condition. They had been experiencing the Blitz for a year, and now the Russians, Germany had gone into war in Russia, so that somewhat dissipated it. But we sent right away, in the spring of 1942, we sent bombers and fighters to England to start a campaign of long-range strategic bombing. And this was a buildup, but it took a long time. It took about a year and a half before we could become very effective, because we were starting from scratch. We had the B-17s, and we also had B-24s. Our fighter pilots could not fly as far as the bombing missions needed. So what happened, we were building up the 8th Air Force. This was something that was not even an 8th Air Force when we started. We just sent airplanes, and gradually it was structured to become the 8th Air Force. And it took, again, until probably late 1943, where we became a viable combat organization. The key was the target for invasion of France was June 1944. We had to have control of the air in order to make the invasion successful. So Arnold's concentration was tremendous in trying to prepare for the invasion in June of 1945. He was successful because in late 43, he got was started to get P-51s to come over the fighters that would give them greater range in support of the bombers. And our number of bombers were huge. And we'd already done a lot of damage in the logistical support area, like on the railroads, the trains, the munition factories, and especially in the aviation industry. So by the spring of 44, we were controlling the air. And on invasion day, June 6, 1944, we controlled everything over the channel. Now, there was a few German planes around, but very few, because by that time, not only were they short on aircraft, but most of the pilots that were trained and combat experience had been killed in action, and many were still in Russia. So Germany was now fighting a two-front war, but they couldn't have done it without the control, and Arnold was very much the boss and the leader in that experience. And
Colonel Rutledge, we have 1 minute left. How would you like to button this up regarding Hap Arnold?
Okay. Hap Arnold was the key to successful victory in Europe with the air, but he also immediately had to turn around and look to the Pacific. And he was in the plans for moving all of our aviation material out there. But neither he nor any of the other people knew of the pending use of the atomic bomb. So they were in the process of moving our air power to the Pacific when the bombs were dropped in early August 1945. And that ended the war. And after that, Arnold then set about structurally organizing the Air Force the way it was for decades and still is. He set up the Tactical Command, Strategic Air Command, Military Air Transport Service, Air Training Command. So he structured the Air Force as it was ready to become a separate branch, which it did in 1947. And Arnold retired in 46, and he lived until 1950.
Okay, Colonel Rutledge, thank you so much for sharing the story of Hap Arnold.
Thank you.
And our quote for the end of the show is from Hap Arnold. He said, "Your limits are somewhere up there, waiting for you to reach beyond infinity." So today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America.
And I don't want no one to cry, but tell them if I don't survive. I was born free. I was born free. I was born free.
The views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker, commentators, hosts, their guests, and callers. They are not necessarily the views and opinions of Crawford Broadcasting or KLZ Management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.